from the JAMA Network. This is the JAMA Pediatrics Editor Summary, a discussion of the most important articles published in the latest issue of JAMA Pediatrics. Here are your hosts, Frederick Rivara and Dimitri Christakis.
Hi there, podcast listeners. This is Dimitri Christakis, Editor-in-Chief of JAMA Pediatrics, the highest impact pediatric journal in the world. With me, as always, is my friend, colleague, mentor, Dr. Fred Rivara, Editor-in-Chief of JAMA Network Open. You and Fred, good to have you here.
Tell us, what is the new impact factor for JAMA Pediatrics?
We are up to 14.
Wow.
Which is a good increase from last year. And of course, your debut impact factor warrants mention as well.
Debut impact factor of JAMA Network Open was 5.0. So that's fantastic.
5.0, that's pretty impressive.
Yes, it is.
Strong work, my friend, strong work. Well, we are coming to you guys today from our respective homes, maintaining appropriate social distance. I hope you all are surviving and maintaining your sanity wherever you are. We have two papers today, quite different and not related to COVID. So
that's
something nice for a change. All right, Fred, you want to go first?
Yeah, the first article we're going to talk about today is the association between state-level criminal justice-focused prenatal substance use policies in the U.S. and substance use-related foster care admissions and family reunification. So this is a paper from colleagues in New York and Washington, D.C., as well as in Austria. And it really is looking at the whole issue of mothers who have CPS call because they use substances during their pregnancy. And it turns out that, as we all know, that there are some states, and actually quite a few states, I think it's 24, that actually make it a criminal penalty if you have used substances prenatally because they view it as child abuse under their child welfare laws. And unfortunately, our state of Washington is one of those 24 states. And so these folks are looking at what happens to kids who are in foster care and comparing those whose mothers who have been put into foster care because of this use of substances during pregnancy compared to children who are in foster care for other reasons. They use a database, which is actually a federal database called the Adoption and Foster Care Analysis and Reporting System, which tracks all foster care kids in the United States. They restricted the sample to infants 1 year or younger who have been removed from their home because of parental drug or alcohol abuse and are really comparing kids in states that have one of the 24 states that have these laws compared to kids in states that don't have these laws. And the outcome that they're looking at is how long do these kids stay in the child welfare system? And we as pediatricians know that no matter how good the foster parent is, that it's preferable to reunite the child with the family if at all possible. The information really is, to me, quite disturbing. First of all, this is a sample of 350,000 children 1 year of age or younger. A big sample from 2005 to 2017. And a third of these children were unified with the parent in states overall, and in states where it was a criminal penalty for use of substance abuse during pregnancy, 31% were reunited compared to 33% in states that didn't have this as a criminal law. So not a whole lot of difference. But I think what is interesting is that there is some major race differences here, and I think it gets down to the whole problem of structural racism. And what these authors found is that in non-Hispanic Black children, the rates of reunification were 13% lower than they were for non-Hispanic white children. 13% lower. And we also know that African-American parents are more likely to have CPS called than our white parents.
Even adjusting for everything else. Right.
And so I think this really emphasizes the problem that the country on the whole is trying to come to grips with, the issue of structural racism. And I think this represents another instance of structural racism here.
Now, what about the issue of prenatal screening for drugs too, Fred? Because isn't that somewhat at the discretion of physicians?
I think that that's a really good point, that that probably also comes into play. We know that, for example, people come into the emergency department, depending upon how you look to the provider, you may or may not get tested for drugs or alcohol. So again, it's another instance where there can be racism deciding who's tested, racism deciding who gets reported to CPS. And it may, we don't know, but there may even be racism about which children are reunited with their parents. But there is structural racism here because there are states that allow this to happen and states that don't.
What is your take on all of this then?
I think that we need to really push that these laws really should be repealed, that the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, the American Medical Association, the American Psychological Association, all advocate against the threat of criminal charges because of substance use during pregnancy.
So you're not arguing against screening, you're arguing against criminalizing drug use.
Also arguing that what we need to do is to better take care of people that have this illness of substance abuse. We know that there are vast differences in who actually gets appropriate drugs, for example, for opioid addiction, and who doesn't. We know that there are big differences by state in who gets appropriate services from CPS and who doesn't. I suspect there's also differences in services to foster children by state. So I think that these laws have created a real mess.
I mean, you could also argue, and maybe you would argue, that what should happen is, one, we should decriminalize them, and two, if there is to be screening, it needs to be universal. That if a state wants to do prenatal drug screening, then it needs to be universal and everybody needs to get it at some point during their pregnancy. And I suppose there the argument would be that you're doing it in order to counsel around substance use and to make appropriate referrals and provide services, in which case it should be available to everybody and there shouldn't be sort of a bias in terms of how it's done.
I agree. I think we also have to look carefully at the whole issue of screening. You know, you and I know that there are criteria to have something be an appropriate screening test. I mean, part of it is, are we going to be able to do anything to help the individuals who test positive on the screen? And if our systems or resources are not set up to be helping individuals who screen positive, then we shouldn't screen.
I think that's exactly right.
So I think this is a very important article. I hope that it's read by state legislators as well as by CPS agencies around the country.
Well, if only it were that easy to change policy is to have legislators and CPS administrators read an article of ours, that would be fantastic. Thanks.
But, you know, I think that, you know, I mean, we have to ask ourselves, why were these laws passed? Were they passed to help kids, to help people, or were they passed to punish people?
Yeah, it's a good question. Okay, the next paper is called The Association of Intrauterine Growth Restriction and Small for Gestational Age Status with Childhood Cognitive Outcomes, a Systematic Review and Analysis. I'll confess that the introduction to this paper was a little bit of an eye-opener for me. So I think everybody knows what small for gestational age is. It means that a baby is born in less than the 10th percentile for their gestational age. Of course, some kids are small because they're just small, right? There are some kids that are in the 10th percentile or less because that's where they fall. Intrauterine growth retardation basically represents what would be deemed pathological growth restriction and is thought to have its roots in deficiencies either in blood flow, in placenta, intrauterine characteristics, etc. But of course, many kids that have IUGR are born SGA. Some, of course, are not. And the question that this study tried to answer is really, what are the effects of babies that are born at IUGR and SGA versus IUGR and AGA? And is there a difference between preterm infants and full-term infants with respect to those two things? Now, I should point out that postnatally, diagnosing IUGR is difficult. It's better done prenatally by looking at umbilical blood flow and other factors that might affect fetal growth.
Can it be diagnosed with the typical ultrasounds that mothers get?
That's a good question. I don't think so. What you can diagnose is the baby is SGA, and then it begs the question of this, the cause of SGA. Is it IUGR or is it something else? So They did a meta-analysis, a systematic review and meta-analysis following all of the appropriate criteria, and identified quite a few studies that enabled them to stratify on IUGR and SGA, IUGR and AGA, and then preterm and non-preterm. And basically what they find is that IUGR babies that are SGA have deficits in cognitive development in the first 12 years of life with an effect size of minus 0.23. And babies that are IUGR and AGA have about the same deficit in cognitive development. That's for preterm infants. And for full-term infants, the differences are if the baby's SGA and IUGR, the effect size is minus 0.34. And if they're IUGR, it's minus 0.39. So the short answer to this is that basically being IUGR and SGA is associated with moderate deficits in cognitive development over the first 12 years of life. And if we do diagnose babies as being SGA on prenatal ultrasound, what are the things that we can think about doing? This is a situation where prevention is begged for, or I guess maybe it's secondary prevention. It's diagnosing that babies are SGA, trying to identify the cause, and thinking about what can be done while the baby is still in utero. And it's not something that pediatricians obviously deal with. We don't deal with women who are pregnant. But I wasn't sure how much research there even was about this particular topic. And in fact, there hasn't been very much. They compiled here tens of studies looking at the effects of intrauterine growth. But really, vanishingly few studies have been done at all on how to properly diagnose it and how to actually treat it. And I think that's what's really needed.
Yeah, a couple of things come to mind when I read this paper. One is that, as we know, SGA is just a kind of symptom, but it could be due to a wide variety of things. It could be due to intrauterine infection. It could be due to genetic anomalies, chromosomal abnormalities, syndromes, which all have very, very different implications for the infant's development. And the authors weren't able to really look into these different causes of SGA. I think the other thing that I think about, which is a hopeful point, is, you know, some studies that were done and have been continuously done the last couple of decades that show early intervention for children at high risk for neurocognitive poor outcomes do work. They do really help these kids tremendously. And we know that from lots of studies. And so I think as pediatricians, we clearly can't affect what happens in the intrauterine environment, but I think we can have affect what happens to the kids once they're born. And I think these kids need to be in those birth to three programs. They need to be in really high quality environments where they're going to be able to kind of recoup the potential deficits they might have sustained because of their SGA status.
At least mitigate them as much as possible. No, I think that's an excellent point. Remains to be seen what all the effects of stress related to all of the women out there that are pregnant during this period of COVID, because we know that stress itself can lead to IUGR, SGA, and I guess we'll be seeing that over the ensuing 9 months and many years to follow.
We actually published a paper in JAMA Network Open not long ago, which looked at mothers that had stress prenatally and then did intrauterine MRIs on their infants and show that those brains of kids whose mothers were stressed were different than those brains of kids whose mothers were not stressed.
Fascinating. So, yes, we've published work like that too. But, you know, I don't appreciate your plugging your journal on
my
podcast.
You know,
but
it's still part of the JAMA family.
We're a family. No,
Have you published those kinds of studies, Dr. Christakis?
We've published those kinds of studies. On that note, I'll advise you all to look. JAMA Network Open does actually publish a fair amount of pediatric content. A lot of it's stuff that we refer there, but a lot of original research that comes directly there. So I would encourage you listeners to look at JAMA Network Open for pediatric articles. You can also subscribe to pediatric table of contents through JAMA. And all of the content at JAMA Network Open is free, so it's widely available in the public domain. Thank you all for spending 15 minutes of your time with us. You can hear other podcasts at jamapediatrics.com. And you can subscribe to this podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. Thank you very much. You'll listen to us hopefully next month. Take care, everyone. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.